So, Paolo and I have decided that he will start with a very interesting short story of what happens with land in a certain part of Peru. And I think it's an excellent way of entering into the questions we want to discuss.
Okay, thank you, Christine. Yes, as a, let's say, as a stimulus, as an input, we thought about this very little story around which I have been working for the past months, let's say. So this is a map of a state of emergency, which was declared by the former president of Peru, Alan Garcia, in 2009. As you know, you cannot see the lines of the map of Peru, but more or less, the lines of the state of emergency cover the entire Amazon that belongs to Peruvian sovereignty. And this state of emergency was declared because there were several protests happening throughout the Amazon, including many blockings of roads, occupations of oil facilities, mining sites, organized by the indigenous movement of Peru. And they were protests mainly about the introduction of a new law, a new forest law. This forest law, what it would do, would potentially change every land in Peru that is defined as forest land, which is part of the public heritage of the country. So every forest land in Peru is defined as belonging to the public heritage of the country, therefore it cannot be privatized. So this new law, this new forest law, would potentially change the legal status of forest lands and would open up those lands to privatization. Now, what is interesting is that in the case of Peru, the kind of legal definition of what is a forest land overlaps with the natural definition of what is a forest land. And the kind of division between the legal and the natural is somehow not precisely established, or they kind of overlap each other. This is the ecological map of Peru. It was elaborated for the first time in early 50s, and it's based on a methodology of climate scientist, if you want to say like this, called Leslie Holdridge. It's called the Holdridge model. And while he was working for the Organization of the American States, he had a kind of laboratory in Puerto Rico, and he developed this model to locate what he called ecological zones, to map ecological zones based on data as, for example, temperature, precipitation, evaporation, and other data that he could gather, and he could make this kind of ecological maps really fast and somehow precise. So this is on the top right corner, you see the so-called Holdridge model of life zone systems, which he developed. And based on that chart, you can somehow map the ecological zones of a country. And this was happening in early 50s, I would say. No, at this time, and later on, the Organization for the American States were somehow very much related to the kind of Cold War context in the sense that was a kind of rush for resources. So this map would allow for you to identify kind of land potential and plan to access those lands. As you can see, Peru has a kind of huge biodiversity. So all this kind of different color patterns are related to different zones of life, as Holdridge called it. But what is interesting is that out of this map, out of this ecological map, they designed a new map which is called land use potential. right? So based on a kind of ecological definition of the life zone systems, they say, well, this land has more potential for this type of economic activity. And it was very much a kind of economic-driven cartography to a large extent. And this is the map of land use of Peru, meaning if you have a forest land, you have potential to forest activities, such as wood, for example. If you have a land which has potential for agriculture, so this land should be used for agriculture. Now, what's interesting is that this ecological map was translated into law. In 75, there is a government in Peru that say every land for you locate, for you should identify what is the potential and what is the type of activity that you can conduct in this land, you have to define according to the Holdridge model, which is somehow based on a kind of ecological vision. So it's somehow as if the kind of nature which was identified by the Holdridge model was transcribed into law. Now, if you analyze this map the way it is, basically, let's say there are several types of land, no? So it's a kind of taxonomy of land. But there is a major division, which is agriculture and forest, right? There is land that can be used for agriculture in different degrees of intensity, and there is land which can be used for forest, but it's not agricultural land. So this is, it's a bit more complicated, but let's stick to this division, which is important, because precisely the law against which people were protesting was supposed to re-legislate the forest land. So if you do an analysis, for example, here I'm taking out in black every land which is defined as forest. Different also qualities of forest, but all forest lands. So this is the area which is defined as forest by Peru. I cannot see the percentage, but as you can see, it's a large part of the country because they have a huge size of the Amazon and some forest also in the coast. If you take the protected areas and the indigenous land, this is the area or the land which would be potentially re-legislate. Now, if you overlap the kind of political line of CH with the land that would be potentially, let's say, enclosed, that would pass through this process of enclosure, right, which was somehow a kind of common land and would potentially be privatized, they kind of overlap. And I think this is interesting insofar as there is a suspension of civil liberties which comes together with a process of privatization, that is, of somehow a kind of expropriation of land, right? But there is a kind of specificity to this law, which I think it's interesting. It was not all the land, all the forest land that suddenly, not all this territory would be suddenly privatized. But there was a kind of detail which is important. Just the land without forest would be open for privatization and potentially to become agricultural land. So it's a kind of deforested forest land that would change its legal status. So, for example, if you concentrate on that region, which is a region of the Amazon, which is like this. So basically, what people who were protesting this law was saying that deforestation would turn into the very means to create private property, right? So destruction would be the very medium of expropriating or appropriating or enclosing land. But what is interesting is that the people who were protesting, they said, well, the forest cover, the surface, cannot be used as a base to define the forest. But in fact, you have to look to the soil. So they kind of came back to the kind of natural definition which is used in Hodrich's model, which is not based only on the surface, but rather based on the soil, to claim that this land should be should stay as a forest. So I think the question here is what in fact defines a forest, and how this new forest land would somehow reshape a kind of natural definition, insofar as this forest or this deforested forest would cease, would not be a forest no longer. So there is a kind of overlapping between the way in which law is somehow reshaping a nature or opening up a kind of possibility for redefining a kind of natural environment. And on the other side, the scientists and lawyers who are saying, in fact, forest cover doesn't define what is a natural forest. You have to look to the soil to define this ecology, right? It's not only the surface, but it's a kind of complex ecology which defines a forest, which ultimately can be characterized by the quality of its soil. So somehow they were using a kind of natural definition or ecological definition of the forest in order to preserve a certain type of law, the old forest law, which would allow to keep those areas as a common land. Let's say.
Yes, I found this story very interesting. I'm going to say a few things in German too, because it's just you know the things you want to say more easily in your own native language. But I found this example very interesting because it reminded me of what happened in the 17th, 18th century in Europe. And this was described beautifully by Karl Polanyi in The Great Transformation, The History of the Industrialization, which he describes in this book. Und in diesem Buch, jetzt wechsle ich auf.
And now a change into German. In this book, he describes the gradual change of the soil, the land was used by everyone, was communal land, and everyone had the right to use the soil as pasture for their animals or grow crops. And all of a sudden, there were enclosures and the land was privatized. That was the very moment where in Europe, the land was not only privatized and thus taken away from the public, but the land became a commodity at that moment in time. And Polanyi says that was the most stupid thing that our ancestors could ever have done, because the land until then was always seen as a community ownership thing, and it was suddenly privatized, was turned into a kind of mobile property. And then he also said all of a sudden this commodity meant that also labor became a commodity. And Karl Marx has described that beautifully as well. And at that very moment in time, many things start changing. The boundaries, the limits start to change, the law starts changing too. And the law starts intervening into ownership relationships, the way in which nature is being thought, and there was also deforestation processes. And at the same time, agricultural areas were created, and they were handed over to private owners who could use them in order to make a profit. And generally, let me also say here, Gary talked about human beings generally defining themselves as human being because they have certain implements, instruments, because human beings can use technology, can use tools, one of the first tools being the plow, the spade. Today we have electronic devices and huge machines that we can use to work in agriculture. And one of the most important processes, so to say, was money. Money is the prosthesis, the tool, the implement that makes it possible to change the use of land. Land seemed to be always something for the community. Nobody had the right to expropriate land. Of course, the king owned the land, but he was only the representative figure for communal ownership. He wasn't the real physical owner of the land. And also the land given to the nobility was delegated land and was used by everyone. And with the beginning of industrialization, there was true privatization. That was a very deep intervention. And I may also add that this intervention takes place in parallel to the emergence of paper money and in parallel to the first ability of man to fly. Montgolfier in 1793 was experimenting, and all of a sudden it was possible for man to look onto the land from above, and that was usually a view that was reserved to God, and all of a sudden this view was possible for men as well, and that made it easier to sort of hand over the land to private owners. I think your stories describes once again what has happened a long time ago, say 150 or 200 years ago in Europe.
And it's interesting because the great enclosures, right? The great enclosures, the great erasure of common lands comes together at this moment when perhaps the Anthropocene is being created. No, so if we date the Anthropocene together with the birth of industrialization, we also have to consider that this came in parallel with this great process of enclosure. So maybe I would ask you how would you connect, let's say, this aspect of privatization of land with the Anthropocene, if that's possible at all, and if there is a connection in that process by which land at a massive scale starts to turn into private property, which is to say you are somehow change a certain type of political ecology. It's not only a question of ownership, but it's also a question of managing resources, of the way you organize socially in relation to the forest itself, in relation to land. So it's not only a question of ownership, as I was saying, but actually a kind of completely transformation of an ecology, but not only an ecology, a political ecology in that sense. And so my question perhaps to you is how could we relate the turning of the land into a commodity in a massive global scale that since industrialization has happened and later on throughout the Third World with the coming of the Anthropocene?
Polanyi says it was the most stupid thing to do because land does not only mean property and the ability to grow the land or have horses on the land or whatever other animals. Land is always tied to relationships, whole professions, vocations, social relationships between families and villages, settlements. Land, the soil, is much more than just a physical entity. Land is where people are anchored. Land is where people derive rights. And the French Revolution was very clever. The French revolutionaries invented the assignats. That's paper money. Paper money that was spent was given to people in order to defend the revolution against foreign forces, and so they handed out assignats, that is to say paper money, and that was covered by the land which was confiscated from the church. One-fifth of all the land was owned by the church in France, and it was then taken away from the church, was confiscated. And on the basis of this land, which was used as security, they issued paper money, but they issued too much, and so the money was devalued. But the French revolutionaries were very clever. They created a law that is still in force, and it says every man... Today, it's every person has the right to go hunting, even though the land as such is owned by somebody else. So the right to go out into the forest to collect mushrooms or go hunting was a right and is a right still that can be claimed by every French citizen. If you go to France today and if somebody tells you, well, go away from here, you will hear that the French citizens immediately claim their right to use the forest. But it was a very clever ruse of the French Revolution to keep this right, because it was still a reminiscence of the old communal land, and that shows once again that the civil rights are very closely tied to the land. And here I also think it's a factor that plays an important role here.
Absolutely. I think what is fascinating in this case is that somehow a kind of reframing of what would be this nature in a certain way that was going through this law was attached with the expropriation of political rights. And I was very touched by what you say, you know, that quoting Polanyi, you know, that land is something from which you draw rights, right? It's the kind of base of a certain types of rights, right? And this reminds me a book which I have been reading more than once by Peter Linenbaum, which is called the Magna Carta Manifesto, Commons for All. And in this book, he is going to recuperate the Magna Carta, which was passed in medieval England, 13th century. And this chart was perhaps one of the first, let's say, human rights documents in the history of humanity, because it aims to protect the rights of the citizens in relation to sovereign power, right? You have the right for a fair trial. You cannot go to prison without a fair trial, and all these other rights that derive, other political and civil rights that derive from this chart. And then he say, well, but you know, you have to go back to this, to the Magna Carta, because it was not the only document created at this moment. In fact, there was the Chart of the Forest. There was the Magna Carta and the Chart of the Forest. And the Chart of the Forest was to protect the rights of communing, of the commons. It's to protect the rights for you to get your wood, to get your energy. No, this was a question of energy, right? For you to warm yourself. It's when there is a certain climate event and you could not get as many crops that as you should. You have the forest as a safety net for your subsistence, right? So what he's saying is that somehow, since the Magna Carta and the Chart of the Forest, they were connected together, we somehow forgot the Chart of the Forest, or let's say the Law of the Forest. We somehow forgot this, and our notions of rights became very much based on a notion, let's say, of the individual vis-a-vis sovereignty in a certain way, right? The way in which we understand civil and political rights. But he's saying, well, we have to go back to this idea of the law of the forest in a certain way, because our liberties, our political liberties, they are connected to land, to our right to access land. And I think in that way, what we see today is very much connected to this, because, and in the case of Peru, very, very much exemplary of this, because the expropriation of a certain type of land, or the right of communing, if you want, is immediately connected with a certain violation of your political rights, meaning expropriation and suspension of political rights come hand in hand, and Peter Linenbaum says a very nice phrase which I have here, so perhaps I'm going to read, so I can quote it on the right. It's here. He says, the robbery of the honey and the robbery of our safety, the robbery of communion and the taking of liberties have gone hand in hand. And to a large extent, I think this is a process that's happening in a massive scale today. After the financial crisis, what we saw, although we are discussing, you know, the Anthropocene, I think, you know, the big companies, the big agricultural companies, the big mining companies, they are continuously producing the Anthropocene. After the financial crisis, when, let's say, capitalism realized that it needs matter again, no, somehow, right? Financial capitalism melted down, but so there was a kind of land rush in Africa, in Latin America, several multinational companies trying to grab land or to secure land, to secure resources, insofar as resources are going scarce, so we have to secure, so kind of buying land because they know that's going to be or some other nations buying land because they know they're going to lack food supply in the future. And in the case of Peru particularly, and Peru has been, for the last years, this is only the beginning of the state of emergency. There were several moments in which states of emergency have been declared, and most of them are associated with resources. Most, if not all of them. Especially mining in Peru, because Peru is very rich on mineral resources. And it's interesting because this expropriation of you access this land, or this safety net, no, he used this word, no, safety net, happens simultaneously with that moment when you became, a being without a property, right? You are the one who needs to have a property, but you don't have, so you have to sell your workforce. This is the process of enclosure, right? You are landless, and the only thing you have it's your energy, right? Labor, and that's what you have to sell in the market. And the massive urbanization that the enclosure has generated is also one of the great sources of the Anthropocene, of the radical transformation of the environment, insofar as our cities have grown enormously, no, and this process somehow continues in a certain way, and to become a landless labor, it's also a worker, it's also when your safety, which the forest provides in a time of bad harvest, for example, you don't have the safety network anymore. So, and then you have to rely on a series of other forms of security, which include insurance and a series of other kind of private means by which you have to try to secure life if you don't have, or either some sort of state, a welfare state for this. Mm-hmm. And so I think this is a question which is somehow contemporary, because one of the main struggles today, I think, from where I come from in Latin America, is to keep people on the land, right? To reverse that process somehow, or because our cities have grown to a certain size that they are incapable of being self-sustained in a certain way. So I think the question of land, we had this idea, no, at a certain moment, I think, that urbanization, you know, like the whole world is urbanized in a certain way. The countryside is something that, you know,
for vacation.
Yeah, but I think it's actually the opposite now. We have to look our societies, urban societies, from a territorial perspective. Always, no, from a relation where the food is produced, how the food gets in, how is the land attached to the city connected, mm-hmm. managed. So I think we are kind of shifting also our perception of this process, and kind of, let's say, coming back to the question of land as so well described by Polanyi in a certain way.
Ja, ich meine, was man auf jeden Fall sehr deutlich sieht.
Well, I think what we can see definitely is the close tie between the question of land and the question of human existence. I mean, human rights, political freedoms, and other things are closely tied to land. And insofar, this question rightly concerns also the future of human existence. Paolo has just talked about insurance. Europe at that time has developed the pension system, has developed welfare states in order to mitigate the consequences of industrialization, the disasters of industrialization. We succeeded in Europe in doing that, at least partly, but as a consequence, human beings became more and more involved into the monetized system, and the human body became also an entity that has a certain value. Either it was devalued in the favelas, where the human body is worth nothing. On the other hand, Austrian scientists have also evaluated certain damage cases where somebody lost a hand or an eye and went to court to get compensation, or the leg was broken, whatever, and those damage cases were decided by courts. And scientists then have evaluated that and have found out that in Germany and in Austria, on average, a body part is worth 1.7 million euros, whereas damages paid to men were much higher than to women. So compensation is not equitable, is not the same for the two sexes, and it's not the same level of compensation that you get when you are right compared to when you're rich compared to when you are poor. But this kind of monetization, the fact that people became landless and had to migrate to the cities, to the slums on the outskirts, of course those bodies were less worth in this kind of monetarized world compared to the bodies of people living in the rich industrialized countries. That shows that rightlessness develops before the law, and even an individual physical body has no significance, or has much less significance, in such a monetized system. So this kind of gap that we see today between the rich and the poor repeats itself again when you calculate the value that individual bodies have.
To pick up on this idea of, let's say, the completely privatization of life as the ultimate realm of capitalist appropriation in a certain way. And to revert this a little bit, I've been doing some work in Ecuador, and in Ecuador they passed a new constitution. This was 2007, if I remember it correctly, in which they grant rights, the kind of similar rights to the human, they grant to nature. And this was something in my work I call non-human rights. How are we going to think non-human rights? And this process of thinking about this came, in fact, after, let's say, the neoliberal decade, no? In which there was a violent process of privatization, if you want, land privatization and other resources privatization. And reflecting upon this new constitutionalism, and it's interesting because the constitution is that which, you know, you, let's say, constitute a polity, right? You know, the kind of refoundation of the Ecuadorian state in a certain way. We have to draft a new constitution in order to establish new rights, because the laws that we have do not fulfill our expectations as a polity, right? So they kind of redo the constitution, but inside this constitution or this polity, this collective, nature is part of this. No, it becomes let's say a subject in a certain way, and it's interesting to see that our usual relation with nature itself is very much based on this kind of objectification of nature, right? And this is totally inscribed in law. So from the point of view of law, there is no other space for the environment besides that of being an object of appropriation. Well, you can say this can be public land, this can be a private land, but ultimately the kind of epistemic frame is nature as an object, right? So they kind of like trying to shift this also, that is to say, well, no, in fact we have to consider a form of life, we have to have a kind of ethics of life or towards life otherwise than human, that cannot be considered as that which is can be appropriated, can be turned into private property, right? Because insofar as you have rights, you became a kind of subject-like entity, you cannot be turned into an object of appropriation. There is a kind of noise there. But what you're saying to me is, in fact, that, you know, when they're trying to protect nature, of becoming nature becoming a subject, humanity, the human body is becoming totally a form of object of appropriation. Which somehow the kind of as if capitalism was much beyond already, no? So perhaps I don't know how would you see this, if you would see this as a form of in your research around money and the kind of commodification of life itself, if you'd see any sort of potential in this attempt to, let's say, reframe nature through a sort of legal code, or any sort of potential in legal codes in redefining reframing the way in through which we'll deal with the world mm-hmm. otherwise mm-hmm. than the human world.
Yeah, ich sehe.
Well, I indeed would be very hopeful if we had a charter which protects nature. But I also think that capitalism is much faster than all possible forms of protection. And biocapitalism claims that the things that we destroy, the forests, we are going to make it more beautiful. We are going to introduce new plants and everything will be nicer. The soil will be more fertile. The trees will be bigger. All kinds of fantasies that you could even see in the 17th century in Francis Bacon when he had his scientific utopia for Nova Atlantis. So biocapitalism is already there to say, no, you don't have to protect nature. We are going to make it better. We are going to make nature better than it ever was before. But that also will have repercussions on humans as well. Men can store their semen in the semen banks and sperm banks, and there are also databases on the number of children that somebody has conceived because of the sperms donated. And if I, as a woman in Romania, donate an egg, I can get 300 euros, and the same thing will cost $5,000 in the US. And so the human body becomes a commodity as well. It's going to be capitalized. And the Supreme Court of California recently decided, that was a couple of years ago, there was a case, a dispute between a woman who had given birth to a child for another woman. She was hired by people to give birth to the child. And of course, and she didn't want to give away this child. And the Supreme Court decided the child is a natural child of the parents who had paid this woman, the surrogate mother, to give birth of it. So the logical consequence is that money can make children. Here we have also the same kind of thing done to humans that is done by biocapitalism to nature. And biocapitalism offers us a kind of opportunity to protect helpless nature, but biocapitalism says, well, we cannot only restore the nature, we can even restore the human body, perfect it, make it better. And a high-tech child where the ovulum and the sperm is donated and where you have a surrogate mother, you would have to pay $100,000. So again, it's money. Money that can make life, can make children.
I would pick one point of what you say because it was a lot. So I'll take like one point, which is this idea that maybe I'm going to ask you something, because it seems to me that you also, when while we were talking, you also make this difference that, you know, capitalism can make nature better, let's say, which implies that nature is there before, that there is a nature, right, that you could make it better or you could preserve. That is, nature is something that is non-human. It's non-human, right?
That's the fantasy. I'm not saying this is right. I'm saying this is the fantasy of biocapitalism. But I didn't want to interrupt you.
No, because what I understood is that what I take from what you're saying is that, let's say, capitalism is going to say, well, I'm going to produce a better nature. And this idea of producing nature would be something that is morally already problematic, this idea of producing a new nature. Through your research about this, well, we're going to produce a new body, so this would be already morally problematically. So this would be a question to you based on something that recently I'm also been reading about, which is new archaeological excavations in the Amazon, huge sites which have been recently discovered that say that in fact the Amazonia is anthropogenic. That the quintessential image of what we thought to be nature, of that which perhaps we could never produce, that's what I'm saying, the idea of producing a nature that, you know, that we should preserve, it's in fact anthropogenic. And actually the most biodiverse parts of the forest are said to be anthropogenic. So the discussion around ecologists, archaeologists, some disagree on this, because some disagree and say, in fact, the Amazon could never, doesn't have the capacity to host complex societies, just the kind of micro-tribes which we think that populate the Amazon, but in fact, there's some other people inside the debate are saying the opposite. In fact, the Amazon is populated by complex societies. So the guys on the one hand, they say, well, if you say this, that the Amazonia is anthropogenic, what you are stimulating is, in fact, this vision of capitalism that we can produce nature. So it doesn't matter. We can produce it again. We did once, so we can produce it again. So some of the people who want to conserve the Amazon say, well, this is bad archaeology because you are stimulating a certain type of view which is, in fact, destructive because you are saying this was created by humans. Now, so this kind of complicated the situation in relation both to nature or to the nature of life itself, because there is a level of production which I felt in your last talk had you have a certain problem with this idea of interfering to a certain level in what is natural.
I think this idea of yours is very, very interesting, that the Amazon, which is really considered the big nature symbol for today, should be anthropogenic. I believe you. I have no reason. I am not an archaeologist of the Amazon, and I couldn't say anything. I think most of Europe, anyway, is anthropogenic, and most of Africa probably is too. So okay. So we say biocapitalism. Biocapitalism is the future of humanity. It's okay, I'm not making any moral statements. I'm not saying this is good or this is bad. We can just say we consider this a fact, but where do we go from there?
Where do we go? It's complicated, but... Well, I think, you know, it's interesting because you're talking about biocapitalism or biopolitics, Foucault, no? He's kind of more or less identifying the birth of biopolitics which overlaps with the Anthropocene, right? Which also overlaps with the Great Enclosures. So it's this massive introduction of the natural world into the systems of government, into the systems of politics, into every level of the organization of society, right? And this is precisely what would be biopolitics. And it's very interesting because Foucault uses also a lot of ecological metaphors, right? So he used this concept called milieu, right? That the kind of biopolitical space is the environment, is the milieu, the way which you organize flows, the way which you organize flows of grants, for example. And I don't see in this, let's say, a priori a problem. Actually, I think we should take this, that, you know, in fact, everything, every part of life has become a question of power. Now, the question is that, considering this, what type of, let's say, political ecology should we take into consideration in order to direct a certain form of production of life as that which is the outcome of power in a certain way. So what forms of power should we organize or political systems in which we are going to produce a certain type of nature? So a priori, I wouldn't have, let's say, a problem with the incorporation of this into our legal or political systems, but rather the opposite, I would say. That we have to seize this and then move forward in a certain way. And I think this idea of biopolitics is very much what those people who passed the constitution in Ecuador are saying. You know, if it's biopolitics, if you know life has entered into the systems of power, so let's protect in some ways what is life, and in that sense, a nature. And the discourse, if you talk to activists, if you talk to people that are involved in those movements, they very much have a kind of biopolitical discourse. It's kind of impressive because they say we are fighting for life in a certain way, almost like life as the species in a certain way, or interspecies. And just to connect with the idea that we're discussing yesterday with Dipesh, that in his text, he wrote a text in what he says, well, maybe in an anthropocenic moment, our new political subjectivity has to be conscious of the species as a kind of political subject. That is to say, we have, beyond the human, we have to think as a species and our relation with other species. Right, that is to say, somehow an ethics of life in a political sense, and I think those movements that are somehow trying in a certain way, that there is of course lots of critiques about this idea of, well, you know, nature has rights. It's kind of problematic. People don't know what this means. You know, it kind of we don't know how to articulate how to use this. But I think at least this shows a certain type of attempt to take this biopolitical present in which we live and kind of turn this upside down in a certain way and redefine, let's say, the epistemic frames in which we frame life itself.
Yeah, ich glaube, dass man diesen Begriff des Lebens...
I think we have to look more closer at the term life. Life here, the Greeks differentiated between zoon and bios. Life can be an individual life, yours or mine, but life can be life in general on our planet Earth. So it's can also be a very general term. So what could happen now, and that is why I was mentioning biocapitalism, what could happen is that humans themselves make themselves superfluous. in this definition of life, that there is life, but humans are no longer needed there. And there's another term, life, in a different meaning, the meaning of general life. But human beings who always felt themselves the masters of life and objective nature. At the same time, humans now become superfluous and become a mere product of money. And that's a difference to the anthropogenic Amazonas area.
Wonderful dialogue.
Already.
It passes so quickly, right?
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.